Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
Hello, everybody. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani. And Zoe is on holiday this week. So while she's enjoying sunny Spain, you've just got me to keep you company this week. Coming up, following on from Labour, the Conservative Party have had their annual conference this week. Some have called it a funeral after their election wipeout. Others were optimistic as the final four battle it out to become the leader of the party. We'll discuss all that with former Justice Secretary Sir Robert Buckland. We'll also look at the Middle East, where tensions have reached a fever pitch as we wait to see if Israel will react after Iran launched a massive rocket attack at its territory on Tuesday night. We'll speak to a former spokesperson to the Israeli government later in the programme. As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up. But first, it's the Week Unwrapped.
I know what leadership demands. When everything else has been cut away and there's nothing left, character is what remains. In Afghanistan and in Iraq, I served in combat alongside the best. And I've seen friends push themselves beyond their limits, and some made the ultimate sacrifice. But when it was hard, when it was tough, we kept going.
Talk is easy. Doing is hard. And we need a leader who can deliver from day one. Someone who has already done the tough apprenticeship that you need to be the leader of the Conservative Party and our next Prime Minister.
Who is Sir Keir Starmer in politics for? Well, the last 3 months have shown us who. Convicted criminals walking free, illegal migrants given an amnesty, well-paid train drivers given yet more money. All the while, the hard-working, silent majority waiting for huge tax rises.
I am a veteran of four government departments and a former cabinet minister. I have seen the system from the inside. Ladies and gentlemen, the system is broken. For too long, politicians have told the public what they wanted to hear and then done their own thing. Well, I say enough.
You heard there from the final four candidates vying it out to replace Rishi Sunak as Conservative Party leader: Tom Tugendhat, James Cleverly, Robert Jenrick and Kemi Badenoch. And that race dominated the annual Conservative Party conference this week. The mood was sombre, with some commentators liking it to a funeral or even a wake following their election drubbing in July. So who might be the next Conservative Party leader, and have the Tories really reflected or actually learned anything since their epic election loss? With me this week to discuss this and some of the week's major stories is the political commentator Stella Chantekadu. Stella, thank you so much for joining us. I'll start off with the easiest question. Who do you think it's going to be?
Oh, James Cleverly. Yeah, I think so. I think he started as a dark horse and everyone underestimated him, because I think he didn't have perhaps the same banter as some of the other ones, and also because he was more associated with the previous Conservative government. He wasn't as fresh, he wasn't as convincing, but throughout the conference, it was extremely obvious that he managed to make a turnaround. And you know, commentariat works a bit like wildfire. One person says something, another journal repeats it, and by the end of the conference, everyone agrees James Cleverly has made a U-turn.
Yeah, and that seems to be, I saw a vox pop of ordinary members of the Conservative Party walking out of the conference hall, and it seemed like the wave was towards Cleverly. Everyone saying that his speech came across prime ministerial, and he looked like a statesman. And as with anything, momentum is huge in leadership elections. Whoever tends to sort of ride that momentum rides it to victory. Who do you think is his closest challenger? Clearly, he's come out of conference riding a high. Who is the closest challenger to him now?
So this is an excellent question and very insightful comment, Ali. I felt the same. I had the pleasure of being present at the Conservative Party.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
And I watched the hustings myself. I was in the room watching the hustings. And I was really surprised and almost felt bad at Tom Tugendhat and at how stressed and nervous he came across, and how some of his strength, the way that he tried to play them, about his army background, for example, seemed a bit desperate, even though he is by far the person who has managed to get the most donations, £150,000 donations so far, when Kemi Badenoch, who until now was considered to be the most likely winner, only got about 40,000. I thought Kemi came across well. She was very relaxed, very, very confident. But I think that a lot of the Conservative members of parliament who will be voting for the whoever is going to make it to the final two will be very anxious about how some of the things that he says, some of the more controversial remarks that he makes, come across and how they make the headlines. Some people say, you know what, the fact that actually Kemi speaks her mind in that way is a very good thing when you are the leader of the opposition, because it's very hard to grab the headlines when you're so far away from government. But some other people say, no, we will have to constantly, she will be putting fires out, and we will have to take care of that, and this is going to be a liability in the future. Bobby Jenrick, Robert Jenrick, you know, he has a very big campaign. He has a lot of important Tory commentators falling in line behind him. The concern I have been hearing over and over again from people who do support him is that they are not entirely convinced that he is who he says he is. He's a bit of a shapeshifter. And there was even one supporter of his campaign who briefed the Times this morning telling them that the reason why Robert Jenrick is going to win is because he's trying to appeal to the reform vote, which is closer to the Conservative Party membership right now, so that he actually wins the leadership. But then once he wins, he wants going to move back to the center and lure back all of these Lib Dem voters. And I was wondering, is this honestly after of Robert Jenrick saying that? Or is this like, you know, an enemy briefing?
Yeah, Stella, can I quickly ask you before we move on to the next point? You were at party conference. What was the mood on the ground? Some have likened it to your funeral.
No, sorry, I disagree. I thought they were all super, super chill, super relaxed, like classic. You know, when you're thinking about the British confidence of a post public school boy, that's what I was coming across. I thought they were having a good time. Like Kemi Badenoch even said it. You know what? It's going to be fun being in the leader of being in the opposition. I love what Tanya Gold said in her piece for Politico. He wrote, "This leadership election gives the conference the appearance of energy. People say the atmosphere is upbeat, but that's Toryism for you. If you want whippers, try Labour. Never forget, Britain enjoyed the bleach," which I think is very insightful.
One might ask why there's so much upbeat energy given they've just been wiped out across the country, but I guess the leadership election has given them that sort of energy of a change at the top. We're going to move on and speak about the biggest story of the week now, the Middle East. This week, Prime Minister Keir Starmer speaking after Iran's launch of a massive rocket attack on Israeli land on Tuesday.
The Iranian regime has launched over 200 ballistic missiles at civilian targets in Israel. It's too soon to assess the impact fully, but I utterly condemn this attempt by the Iranian regime to harm innocent Israelis, to escalate this incredibly dangerous situation and push the region ever closer to the brink. It cannot be tolerated. We stand with Israel and we recognise her right to self-defence in the face of this aggression. Iran must stop these attacks, together with its proxies like Hezbollah.
That was Keir Starmer speaking on Tuesday. While Iran says its strike was in direct retaliation for Israeli strikes on Hezbollah leadership in Lebanon, as well as a numerous Israeli military attacks, including one on the Iranian consulate and the killing of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran, the former Hamas leader. Israel has succeeded in knocking out most of the group's key players in targeted strikes, including the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, who had been in power for more than 3 decades. While Israel continues its attacks on Hezbollah in Lebanon today and has launched, as of current, limited ground incursions into the country's south. Questions also remain if Israel strike back at Iran. The G7 has warned Israel against such an action. Stella, the Middle East is probably closer to the brink of all-out war as it has ever been, certainly in my lifetime. What needs to happen next to calm the situation down and to avoid further escalation?
Exactly as you're saying, it's very close to breaking in an all-out war. And at the same time, we're seeing Middle Eastern politics and the situation there once again having more and more importance in UK politics, and more British politicians having to respond to that, and voters being very, very concerned and extremely polarized. I was listening to people at Tory Party conference speaking about this during the week, and also other people who have very, very different opinions. And it's becoming an incredibly difficult political issue for a Labour government to navigate. I think that what this shows us is how important who is going to be the winner of the US elections is going to be. Keir Starmer, the Labour government, has very rightly said they are not going to decide who is going to be the next ambassador, UK ambassador, to the US until after the US elections. Because whatever happens in the US elections is going to have a massive impact on British foreign policy when it comes to China, when it comes to Russia, when it comes to the Middle East. Things are going to be very, very difficult. So far, we have not seen much action from European leaders who are very preoccupied with their own problems. We have seen the rise of the far right in Germany, now in Austria, in France, in Italy. And this is making it very, very difficult for them to have a stronger position when it comes to Israel and the rest of the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And really, what is there to do for European countries? Because up until now, the reason why countries like the UK were able to have such a strong position on defense and foreign affairs is because they had behind them the might of, you know, international aid, of their military. Now, everybody knows that these capabilities are no longer there. We only have diplomacy at our hands. And at that, it seems that so far, diplomacy has been failing. Mm.
Can I ask, Stella, a last question on this is, what could the implications for Sir Keir Starmer be here in the UK? We know the issue of Israel and Gaza cost him MP seats at the last general election, at least. Jonathan Ashworth would still be sat in the Commons had it not been for Labour's positioning on Gaza. How careful does he not to be to lose more seats, given that Wes Streeting hung on with 500 votes, as did a couple other MPs with smaller majorities than they would have liked? How careful does Keir need to be?
He needs to be incredibly, incredibly careful, because also a lot of his MPs have very, very strong views on this matter. And again, people are extremely polarised, and obviously the Labour Party still has the shadow of anti-Semitism and very good reasons why they want to show very strong support for Israel. But at the same time, they have been moving more and more to a more pragmatic position, and one in which, frankly, it acknowledges the reality of this war, which is absolutely horrifying to the average British voter. Looking at the death toll that this conflict has brought about is absolutely horrifying for voters across the political
spectrum. Yeah, and we've seen that in the polling, certainly from YouGov, in British attitudes towards the war. Stella, you rightly mentioned the US elections and the importance that will play in this role. We're going to move on to that now, from the Middle East to the US, and particularly what was a rather polite political debate.
You have got housing that is totally unaffordable because we brought in millions of illegal immigrants to compete with Americans for scarce homes. The people that I'm most worried about in Springfield, Ohio, are the American citizens who have had their lives destroyed by Kamala Harris's open border. It is a disgrace, Tim. And I actually think, I agree with you. I think you want to solve this problem, but I don't think that Kamala Harris does.
Senator, your time is up. Governor, you have 1 minute to respond.
Yeah, well, it is law enforcement that asked for the bill. They helped craft it. They're the ones that supported it. That's because they know we need to do this. Look, this issue of continuing to bring this up, of not dealing with it, of blaming migrants for everything. On housing, we could talk a little bit about Wall Street speculators buying up housing and making them less affordable. But it becomes a blame.
That was J.D. Vance and Tim Walz, the vice presidential running mates to Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, respectively, in an oddly agreeable debate on Tuesday night. The two men spent much more time attacking each other's running mates than each other during the 90-minute debate on CBS News stage in New York. Stella, let's start with the debate. It was an awfully civil compared to what we're used to with Donald Trump on the stage. Do you think there was a clear winner?
I don't think there was a clear winner. I think it's quite common for vice presidential debates to focus on the main ticket candidate rather than the vice president. I thought that Vance came across as more polished in the way that he was dressed and the way he carried himself, which makes sense because he's a senator. He's very, very well practiced on commentating on right-wing media such as Fox News. We know that Tim Walz is, you know, he has a very different background, and part of the reason why he was elected is because he comes across as more someone a lot more relatable. I thought his confidence did not always shine through, and even though I felt that Vance made more mistakes when it came to policy, he struggled quite a few times to respond to questions.
It seems
for immigration,
It seems J.D. Vance overperformed the expectation of him coming into the debate, and Walz underperformed. So while you may look at the debate in isolation and go, it was pretty even, most people expected Vance to bomb and he didn't, and most people expected Walz to win easily and he didn't.
Perhaps, and I think an insight that comes out of your comment is the fact that if I were a Republican voter, I would watch the debate and think Vance won, whereas if I was a Democratic voter, I would watch the debate and think Tim Walz won, because both of them had the key points, you know, on immigration, on gun control, on healthcare, on housing, on everything, that would appeal to the voters.
Yeah, and that's probably what the top ticket candidates will have wanted in both Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. That's The Week Unwrapped. Thank you so much to our political commentator, Stella Chantekadu, for joining me this week. Coming up, the Tory leadership race continues to heat up with just a couple of weeks left until Rishi Sunak's replacement is decided. We'll speak to former Justice Secretary Sir Robert Buckland about who he expects to win next on Politics Uncensored.
FUPAR Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
What's kind of that one golden thing that you like to share with people who are trying to start a business?
That's a really easy one, because I have a mantra which, you know, I say to young people all the time, and they really get it when I say it. And it goes like, don't undermine who you are by comparing yourself with someone else. It's because we are all different. Why each of us is special.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favorite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
It's the sound of your mates alive. It's getting to more gigs this year and the next. It's the sound of saying, I got you, mate. It's the sound of mates enjoying even more of this. It's the sound of mates getting home instead of here. Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't think.
When you notice something wrong, it tends to grow and eventually take over, to the point you can't really think of anything else. If something in your body doesn't feel right, the thought it could be cancer can play on your mind. Tests could put your mind at rest. Finding out sooner is always better. Your NHS wants to see you. Contact your GP practice.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Three words to describe yourself.
Weird, funny, and quirky. I'm a strange guy.
Oh, I love that. That's good. Not many men would say that. Normally they're like, yeah, strong.
No, do you know what? That's what people think I'm going to be. Like, they see, like, the gym and the muscles and the tattoos, and they think I'm going to be, like, this, like, serious, like, fuckboy, like, lad. You know what I mean? And then they meet me. And I'm like a Jim Carrey. I'm like a muscly Jim Carrey.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
What's going on in the DMs? Are you getting naughty pictures from fans? Girls, are you getting the odd little pic? I bet they're popping the DMs.
Yeah, the DMs are doing all right. I've got a lot of cousins, big family, so they're all touching base.
Yeah.
There's a few girls in there as well. I've had some fruity videos come through.
Oh, so, tell us a little bit more.
You
want
to go there?
Yeah, we're going there. Access all areas, mate.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Malani. Now, it was Tory Party conference this week, and you'd have heard earlier in the programme a brief montage of the Tory leadership candidates. They are Tom Tugendhat, James Cleverly, Robert Jenrick and Kemi Badenoch. Well, who's in pole position to win, and what is the mood like in and around the party following their election loss in July? Joining us to discuss this is Sir Robert Buckland, a former Conservative Justice Secretary. Robert, thank you so much for joining us. Let's start off with conference. Do you think the mood from conference shows that the lessons are starting to be learned as to why you lost?
I think so. I got a sense of optimism there, but also realism that the beating we had in July was a very bad one. People voted for other parties, not just Labour, but the Lib Dems and other parties. And a lot of people stayed at home as well because they couldn't vote for another party but didn't want to vote for the Conservatives. So it was a perfect storm for the party. And the reason for that is that people lost confidence and trust in the ability of a Conservative government to deliver for them on issues like the economy and health and all those important issues that matter to all of us in our daily lives. And therefore, we've got a lot of work to do, a lot of ground to make up. And we're really at the beginning of this with the selection of a leader who will then need to do a heck of a lot of work, not just in Parliament, but also out there in the country, talking to communities and organisations and people about what it is that they want to see from their government. And that work will take quite a few years, I think, before we are given that opportunity to serve once again.
And of the four Conservative Party leadership hopefuls that we saw on stage at the end of the conference, did any catch your eye? Did anything they say catch your eye? Who do you think is in pole position?
Well, I haven't personally decided who to vote for. I'm a member like many other people, and I'll have a vote in a couple of weeks' time when the field has whittled down to just two of the candidates by the MPs in Westminster. I thought that James Cleverly had a good conference. I thought he spoke very well yesterday. He, in particular, struck me as understanding the fact that the party must be normal. We've got to talk about issues that matter to people and not go off on some wild tangent, talking about things that might be of great interest to us, but which are irrelevant to the lives of the people we serve. You know, it's not our job to be weird. It's our job to not just listen and react to people, but to lead on the issues that matter, whether it's the economy, whether it's our security in the world, or whether it's things like the health service or our schools and our public services. That's where we need to be. And I thought James encapsulated that very well.
What about the other three? Who do you think is probably closest to him? Because I asked that, it seems very clear James Cleverly is in pole position coming out of conference. He's certainly got the most positive headlines. Who's the closest to him?
Well, the numbers actually at the moment show that Robert Jenrick is the candidate with most MPs support. We'll see how that develops in a vote of MPs as early as next week. I think Tuesday or so we'll have another vote. And I think that Kemi Badenoch, who's somebody I've known well for years and worked with, is a person who I think now needs to really get on the front foot and talk about issues like housing, which is, of course, her shadow brief, and the economy, because on those issues, she's strong. She's absolutely understanding the need for there to be aspiration and new housing, for particularly for younger people. And that's what I want to hear from her in particular. And then Tom Tugendhat, who I think has fought a very spirited campaign. I was particularly impressed, I think, by the way in which he has been strong on security issues and understanding Britain's position in the world and how that affects our economy and how we do things here at home. So we've got some good candidates. I think once the decision is made, it's it's absolutely essential that everybody unites behind the leader and stops the sort of squabbling that has damaged us in the past.
Do you see any of them a leader that can win the 2029 general election, 2030 general election, wherever it might come?
Well, I mean, if we were here 4 years ago and talking about Sir Keir Starmer's election as Labour leader, I don't think any of us would have thought that he would have been.
No, I don't think he would have.
No, I don't think you would. So this is the thing about modern politics. It's very volatile and people are no longer, you know, prepared to just sit things out and wait for years before they change their view. You know, Labour have got a couple of years in which to persuade people that they can govern, and they may well lose the faith and trust of people if they don't live up to their promises. And therefore, the Conservatives have to be ready. And that's why they're going to have to hit the ground running. They're going to have to work on policies and ideas. They've got an opportunity now in opposition to listen to groups and organisations that will have interesting proposals. And then we need to agree what they are and to come back as a party that represents aspiration and the best of our future. That's where the Conservatives have done well in the past. That's what we've got to aspire to now in the future if we are to win the votes of younger people and the next generation.
Yeah, so one of the things that was, I think, clear in the general election was there was a sort of damning indictment from voters, particularly Conservative voters, of the last sort of regime of Conservative Party leadership. I don't just want to put it at Rishi's door because it was a number of different leaders. One of the things Sir Keir Starmer did when he came into his leadership was detach himself from previous leadership, from the previous leadership. Does whoever comes in need to do that, distance themselves from the previous sort of administration and regime? And do you think they can do that, particularly if it's someone like James Cleverly, who held many briefs under that administration? What, as did Keir Starmer?
Well, indeed. I mean, you're right to make the point. Keir Starmer was in Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet as a leading member dealing with the Brexit fallout. Indeed, he was his friend. And if you remember, he got elected on quite a left-wing manifesto, which he then managed to junk progressively as the months ticked by. Now, I don't think the Conservatives are in that sort of position. We don't. We're not hostage to ideological forces. We are pragmatic people who like to, we have our principles about trying to make sure that we spend people's money wisely and that government is does what it does best but doesn't try to do everything, and that we try and keep taxes low. It's been difficult because of the cost of COVID and the fallout from that crisis. But I do think the next leader does need to draw a line and to, first of all, say a heartfelt apology for the failings, and then an acknowledgement that because of that failure, the British people exercised a very clear verdict on the party. And with that acknowledgement and admittance of wrong, of fault, then I think the public will start to give the Conservatives an airing, start to listen to some of the ideas that they will put forward. It's going to be slow work. Opposition is not great. I mean, your best day in opposition is never as good as your worst day in government. Mm-hmm. And having been in government myself and having exercised that power and responsibility, it is a fulfilling and rewarding role. Mm-hmm. Opposition is frustrating. You can't achieve those things. But what you can do is hold the government to account and then present yourself as a government in waiting. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think the Conservatives' task is in the next few years.
So I wonder if I can ask you about reform, because if you look at the election, actually, some analysts might say that it wasn't so much Labour that handed the Conservatives defeat, it was the Reform Party. And there are fears that reform could overtake the Conservatives in the polls. They're only single digits in some polls away from the Conservative Party. How much of an existential risk does the Reform Party and Nigel Farage present to the Conservative Party? And is there a risk as a result of that, that the some Tories may try and be some form of imitation of reform?
Well, I think that all alternatives are a risk to the Conservatives, because we were losing votes to reform. We lost some to Labour. We lost a lot to Lib Dems in certain seats in the South. And we also lost even votes to the Green Party. Two seats went to the Green Party. So it was a perfect storm of opposition to the Conservatives, where people decided to vote for who they thought was best placed to beat them. I think it would be a mistake if we overly focused on reform. I think that whilst a lot of the voters who voted Reform did so for understandable reasons, and we've got to listen to them and win them back, I don't think aping Nigel Farage is going to win us the sort of votes that we need to garner from younger people and indeed from those people who voted for other parties and to whom we lost seats like the Lib Dems. So what the Conservatives have to be is sure about themselves, and they have to be competent, and they have to be united, and they have to present a fresh approach that will attract people to our colours rather than defining ourselves according to what our opponents say and think. You know, if we do that, we risk then becoming just a nothingness, which is, of course, not the tradition of Conservatism. It is a strong part of our political landscape. In fact, the oldest and most successful party in the world, and I would hate to see that the centre-right disappearing as a mainstream force from our politics. We'd all be poorer as a result, whatever our political persuasion. Mm.
Can I ask you one last question? You mentioned that the Conservative Party is a party of pragmatists, and that's proven to be the case. If anything, the Conservative Party has been an election winner more than anything, and you're not the party of ideologues. Suella Braverman, certainly an ideologue. Does she have a place in the future of the Conservative Party? And if so, why didn't she run?
Well, it's up to her, and presumably she didn't run because she didn't have the support. Suella, I've known for a number of years. I remember her as being a mainstream conservative. I've been a little surprised by some of the comments and positions that have been taken of late.
Oh, so she's changed over the years.
She has. I mean, look, we all evolve and change, but it's quite a dramatic change. And some of the policy positions, I think, are ones that do not sit well with conservative principles. However, people can change further. And I wouldn't like to think that somebody with that track record in the party would disappear. I do hope that in the new under the new leadership that she will find space and a place to make her case, but to do so in a way that is absolutely part of the conservative tradition and not a genuflection and a knee-bowing, in other words, to populist right-wing politics that belongs more to the world of Donald Trump than it does to the world of the UK Conservative Party.
Thank you so much. That was Sir Robert Buckland, former Conservative Justice Secretary. Really insightful conversation about the future of the Conservative Party. We just heard from Sir Robert Buckland, former Conservative Justice Secretary, and he gave us an interesting insight into Conservative Party conference and what faces Tories in the coming years as they try and rebuild from what was a pretty disastrous election campaign. A couple of interesting points from what we heard from Sir Robert Buckland there, I think, particularly on Suella Braverman, talking about how she's changed. And only Suella will know this as to whether it was an opportunistic change given the rise of Reform and the far right in the country, or whether she's genuinely had an ideological shift. As Sir Robert Buckland said, she was more of a mainstream conservative in previous years. The thing about the Conservative Party, in my view, has always been that they're an election-winning machine up until this last one, and they're able to reshape and reform themselves, no pun intended, in government often, and reflect what they think they need to do to win a general election. Now, they haven't faced an election result quite like what they did in July, but the key question facing whoever the leader will be, and it's clear that James Cleverly has come out of conference with the most momentum, though Robert Jenrick seems to be the one who's got the largest party support, is what do they do about Reform? So if you empty the space to the right, then it's likely that Reform will continue to build on that base and will continue to hammer on immigration or on crime, for example, and the space that the far right likes to operate in. And if they come into the centre, then they can compete with Labour, which Sir Keir Starmer has certainly brought Labour to the centre, at least, being kind to him, in that space. But the risk is that they take the advice of someone like Suella Braverman, and they shift to that right-wing space, and they become a sort of pale imitation of Reform. So they find themselves in a really difficult political situation as to what their future looks like. And I think we'll keep an eye on that in the coming weeks and months. And voices like Sir Robert Buckland will be really interesting to hear from. But coming up, We're going back to the Middle East, and we'll discuss the rising tensions in the region with a former spokesperson for the Israeli government. All that and more next.
FUBAR Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
What's kind of that one golden thing that you like to share with people who are trying to start a business?
That's a really easy one, because I have a mantra which, you know, I say to young people all the time, and they really get it when I say it. And it goes like, don't undermine who you are by comparing yourself with someone else. It's because we are all different. Why each of us is special.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favorite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way. From this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out!
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Three words to describe yourself.
Weird, funny, and quirky. I'm a strange guy.
Oh, I love that. That's good. Not many men would say that. Normally they're like, yeah, strong.
No, do you know what? That's what people think I'm going to be. Like, they see, like, the gym and the muscles and the tattoos, and they think I'm going to be, like, this, like, serious, like, fuckboy, like, lad. You know what I mean? And then they meet me, and I'm like a Jim Carrey. I'm like a muscly Jim Carrey.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
What's going on in the DMs? Are you getting naughty pictures from fans? Girls, are you getting the odd little pic? I bet they're popping the DMs.
Yeah, the DMs are doing all right. I've got a lot of cousins, big family, so they're all touching base.
Yeah.
There's a few girls in there as well. I've had some fruity videos come through.
Oh, so, tell us a little bit PG. More.
You go there?
Yeah, we're going there. Access All Areas, mate.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani. And let's return to the Middle East. And following Iran's attack on Israel and Israel's continued campaigns in Gaza and now Lebanon, the region sits on something of a precipice as Israel's ways of responding to the Iranians is up in the air. Well, joining us to discuss this is Alon Levy, former spokesperson for the Israeli government and now head of Israeli Citizen Spokesperson's Office. Alon, thanks so much for joining us. Let's start with Iran's missile attacks on Israel, if I may. The G7, including the United States, has today maintained their call for Israel to not strike back into Iranian territory. President Biden has said that he wouldn't support such an action, particularly on the nuclear sites. In your opinion, what has to happen next?
Israel doesn't have a choice now but to respond in a very serious way that makes the tyrants of Tehran pay a price for their aggression. We have been under attack by the Iranian regime and their proxy armies on seven fronts for a whole year now. I don't know if people understand that in Israel we have rockets coming in from four or five different directions every day. And Iran just massively escalated with what I think is the biggest ballistic missile attack in history. Now, last time Iran did this in April, Israel was encouraged to, you know, take the win and not respond. And I think the lesson that Iran's leaders took is that they can attack Israel again with impunity. As long as a coalition of Western states blows most of the missiles out of the sky, Israelis just have to run to the bomb shelters and accept it. And Israel now needs to restore deterrence and make it clear to the Ayatollahs in Tehran that they cannot hide behind their proxy armies. And there is a cost for forcing 10 million people to run into bomb shelters, to run from ballistic missiles.
The response from the Iranian side would be that the escalation has come from Israel. You mentioned the rocket attacks and the exchange of fire with Israel. 85% of that rocket, that fire exchange has come from the Israeli side. Israel has hit the Iranian consulates, has killed Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran. And so the noise from Tehran would be that the escalation has almost unilaterally been on the Israeli side.
Well, Iran's strategy has been to surround Israel with a ring of fire and try to set it on fire. Iran has surrounded Israel with a coalition of proxy armies that have been attacking Israel every day for a whole year now. And Iran's leaders, their strategy is to try to hide behind those proxy armies. So this war started on October 7th with Hamas's invasion and that brutal massacre. We're about to mark 1 year. The following day, Iran's proxy army in Lebanon, Hezbollah, joined the war, raining missiles on northern Israel, over 9,000 rockets. We now have 60,000 people who have been displaced for over a year. They can't go home because of Hezbollah's attacks. The Houthis in Yemen, just overnight, we had an attempted drone attack on a suburb here of Tel Aviv. It woke many people up, the explosions. Add to that drone and rocket attacks from Syria and from Iraq, from the Iranian militias, and attacks by Palestinian terrorist groups backed by Iran as well. And Israel has been fighting for its life against the Iranian regime and its proxy armies for a year now on seven fronts. This is an escalation that started with Hamas, continued with Hezbollah, continued with the Houthis. And why? Well, the reason is pretty clear. You know, the Iranian regime chants death to Israel, death to America. Death to Israel, cursed be the Jews, is literally part of the Houthis' official slogan. And they do it because their endgame is the destruction of the state of Israel. Obliteration, annihilation. That is the goal of the fundamentalist regime in Tehran. And what Israel is trying to do now is to make that aggression stop so that we can safely return our people to their homes on the northern border with Lebanon, on the southern border with Gaza, get the hostages out, of course, and not have to live in fear of constant ballistic missile attacks on multiple fronts.
You speak about death and fear. The vast majority of the criticisms are levied at Israel over the last year has been the way that it has conducted itself, both in Gaza and now in Lebanon. Speaking of Lebanon first, we've had 1,974 people now killed, 500 in a single day, which was, I think, something like 30% of the entire death toll of the 2006 war. What has constantly followed Israel in both its campaigns in Gaza and in Lebanon has been accusations of war crimes. And the number particularly of children being killed. Is Israel's response restrained by any level of international law, or from the evidence, does it not care at all about who dies in the wake?
No, Israel cares deeply, and it's made clear that its war is against Hamas and Hezbollah, not the people of Gaza or Lebanon. And that's why every military expert who has examined Israel's operations in these fiendishly difficult counterterrorism urban battles has concluded that Israel's rules of operation are at least as rigorous as the UK and other NATO militaries. That was the Deputy Supreme Commander of NATO who said that. Israel is fighting a war in which...
Yes, but Elon, the human rights organization, Oxfam International, has said more women and children have been killed in Gaza by Israeli military than any other recent conflict. UNICEF has said there are no safe spaces for children, save the children have said there's no safe spaces for children, and thousands of children have had either one or both legs amputated. The World Health Organizations have said children are starving in Gaza as a result of the famine, which many label at Israel. Human Rights Watch, United Nations, Amnesty International, all of these organizations have leveled very serious crimes against humanity, against Israel, for their campaigns in Gaza and now in Lebanon.
I don't want for a moment to downplay that there is suffering in Gaza. There is. And it is because...
at the hands of the Israeli military.
And no, the suffering is happening because Gaza's psychopath leaders declared a needless war on October 7th, in which they burned Israeli children alive, committed barbaric acts of gang rape, abducted 250 hostages, and took them into the Gaza Strip, having dug a tunnel network longer than the London Underground, deliberately in order to hide their military assets under civilian areas. And Hamas did that because its strategy is not to use civilians as human shields, but human sacrifices. It hides under civilian areas to tell the Israelis, look, you can only get to our military assets that are under schools, under hospitals, and UN facilities if you go through civilians. That's why you have seen the Israeli military repeatedly warning people to evacuate and get out of harm's way so that we can target the Hamas infrastructure.
And yet when people are evacuating, those evacuation sites are also being targeted, according to reports.
And this is what is so horrific about Hamas's human shield strategy.
But you're just refusing to accept any culpability from Israel.
Israel urges people to leave to places where it is safer, where Hamas is not operating.
And then targets those same sites.
Because Hamas then keeps embedding itself among civilians. And Hamas keeps embedding itself and moving among civilians in order to keep them in harm's way. You know,
one of the most densely populated areas in the world. And therefore, you know, civilians have nowhere to go. And that's the point. Children in Gaza have nowhere to go. That's what Save the Children is saying. That's what the World Health Organization is saying. That's what UNICEF is saying. And when they're told to evacuate, both the route to evacuation and the evacuation sites are being targeted. I want to ask you about a specific case.
I'm sorry. That was a very serious allegation, and I would like to respond.
Go ahead.
Just a few weeks ago, I went down south to meet soldiers, and I asked them, what do you want me to tell people in the media? And one of the soldiers said, I want you to tell them how I was shot at by Hamas while I was securing the humanitarian evacuation route for people to leave. The organizations may say this. It doesn't make it true. In the early days of the war, Israel went to the United Nations and said, look, Hamas has deliberately rigged the urban battlefield to hide its military structures under schools and homes and hospitals. We want to set up a tent city in open areas so people can get out of harm's way. And the United Nations and the other organizations refused to cooperate. I think it's the only example in world history of the UN refusing to help evacuate civilians from a war zone to places where they would be safer.
Can I just ask you?
There needs to be accountability about those attempts to block Israel's efforts to keep the civilians on the other side safe from their own leaders' attempts to keep them in harm's way.
So you, when I asked you about these international organizations, you said just because they say it doesn't make it true. Are you then saying Oxfam International, UNICEF, Save the Children, Amnesty International, the United Nations, Human Rights Watch, World Health Organizations are all lying?
Yes, I am. I'm saying these are organizations that never, at any point in their reports, quote any military experts with knowledge of what urban battlefield looks like. They deliberately ignore the voices of experts who know what the fight against ISIS.
They are experts themselves.
No, they are not military experts. They rely on local.
No, they're human rights experts. That's the point.
Hamas or intimidated. But they do not understand how international law is applied in the context of urban war.
Okay, well, when we're talking about that, let's talk about a specific case. Hind Rajab, which you will know about, 6-year-old child who was evacuating, as you say, into a safe area, ended up being a lone survivor of an Israeli airstrike as she was evacuating. And we've seen that paramedics came to her aid to save her in the airstrikes. She was then subsequently killed in a follow-up attack, and the paramedics alongside her were also killed. When I asked you about Israeli culpability, you said no. Who is responsible for Hind's death?
I'll be honest with you. I don't know the specifics of that case. I know that the army is looking into it, and I expect there to be full accountability if it turns out that there was any misconduct by our troops. But let's remember why Israel is fighting and what is at stake in this war. The first thing that Hamas did after it committed the October 7th massacre and took 250 hostages was to pledge to do it again and again.
Now, Elon, I understand that, but the question here is about Israel's conduct in its response. It's not whether it should or shouldn't respond. It's about its conduct.
I'm saying in that specific case, I'm being honest and saying I don't have the information at hand. I know that the army is looking into it, and I look forward to seeing what the results are.
I mean, look, but I can also my listeners will have enormous skepticism about the Israeli army, about whether they can be honest on war crimes that they themselves have committed. The question is, why don't you allow journalists? Journalists have routinely been denied access. In fact, 116 journalists and media workers have been killed in Gaza, which, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, is the deadliest period since data began. Why don't you allow independent journalists into Gaza so they can document these allegations of war crimes?
Sure. You mentioned the list from the Committee for the Protection of Journalists. I wonder if you can tell me how many of those journalists worked for Hamas-affiliated media?
I couldn't tell you.
About a third. According to the Committee for the Prevention of Journalists, mm-hmm. Committee for the Protection of Journalists, about a third of the people on those lists are Hamas content creators.
What about the other two-thirds?
They deserve
well,
to
the
die.
Other two, well, many of those we know, for example, worked for Hamas. Like Ismail Kadul, there was a great uproar.
You've just told me a third worked for Hamas. I'm talking about the other two-thirds who presumably don't.
A third worked for Hamas-affiliated media. Mm-hmm. Many others, Israel has already shown, were working for Hamas's military wing, not Hamas media, Hamas's military wing, while moonlighting as Al Jazeera journalists.
So these 116 journalists you're telling me are Hamas?
I'm saying some of them are. And that has been documented, and you can look up the names. I'm saying, according to the Committee for the Protection of Journalists, at least a third of those worked for Hamas media. You cannot be a journalist and work for an international terrorist organization. But I'll answer your question specifically about why Israel hasn't allowed international media into Gaza freely. First of all, it has allowed international media to enter on embeds with the Israeli army. But the fear, as the Supreme Court has accepted the government's claim, is that the presence of international media in Gaza could expose troop movements. And the army needs to thread a very difficult needle. It needs to make sure that soldiers are safe and that reporters will not give away their troop movements in a way that could alert Hamas to where they are and expose our conscripts and reservists who didn't ask to be in the war in Gaza there in the first place. Now, personally, I think that if we allowed international journalists into Gaza, it would be net positive for us, because at the moment, all the information coming out of Gaza is from journalists who either work for Hamas or are cowed by Hamas or are sympathetic to Hamas, right? So I personally think...
Elon, do you know how ridiculous it sounds that we're talking about 116 journalists and media workers who've lost their lives, bravely many of them, covering allegations of war crimes, and you have just slandered them entirely with either being members of Hamas or cowed by Hamas or influenced by Hamas? Do you know how offensive that is to journalists listening around the world, many of them who give their lives in dedication to documenting horrific actions, including like the deaths of Hind Rajab?
Well, let's remember what the Gaza Strip is. Gaza is controlled by an authoritarian regime. Hamas is an authoritarian regime. I hope no one disputes that. In an authoritarian regime, there is no press freedom. There is no freedom for people to report things that are inconvenient to Hamas. That's why none of these brave journalists...
Well, no, they can't report it because you won't let them in.
No. I'm talking about the Gazan journalists on the ground. The Gazan journalists. None of them have ever produced a single headline, a single photo, a single piece of information that is inconvenient to the Hamas regime, because they know that Hamas governs through brutality and repression. And there have been cases inside the Gaza Strip of individuals who have reported information inconvenient to Hamas who are subsequently executed. There is no media.
That's also a crime, and no one would disagree with that. I've got one more question for you while I have you, and I appreciate your time. We're now in the stage where at least 50,000 people have been killed at the hands of the Israeli military in Gaza. Research from The Lancet suggests that it's closer to 350,000, 11,000 children. And as a result, British public opinion has changed. Anywhere from 69 to 73% of the British public are calling for all Israeli military operations to end and for a ceasefire. 56% support ending all arms sales to Israel. 67% think Israel has committed war crimes. And 54% now suggest that they would support arrest warrants for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. You have completely lost the British public, haven't you?
Well, first of all, let me push back on those numbers. The Lancet, for example, complete poppycock. What the Lancet did was
we'll add Lancet to Oxfam, UNICEF, Save the Children, Amnesty International, United Nations, Human Rights Watch, World Health Organization.
I don't think you've read the Lancet letter. I don't think you've read the Lancet letter, because what the letter does is it takes Hamas's figures, multiplies them by five for no obvious reason in order to make a speculative projection. And one of the authors later admitted it was indeed only illustrative. They take the number provided by Hamas.
Because we don't know, because many people are buried under rubble. But on the question, are you concerned about losing the British public?
One moment. Hamas systematically lies about the death toll. In every previous war, it has lied about the number of combatants who were killed, and it is not a source that can be trusted. But I'll answer your specific question. Yes, there has been a horrific campaign of misinformation that has been waged against Israel. And the reason is that Iran, Palestinian terrorists, their supporters, they want to destroy Israel. That is their goal. And when you see people on the streets chanting "from the river to the sea," they mean no more Israel in the middle. And they think it will be much easier to destroy Israel if Western publics, good, ordinary people in the UK, the US, are convinced that Israel deserves to be destroyed. And that's why you see the most outrageous and baseless allegations being leveled against Israel, to bring the British public to a position where the next time Iran tries to fire ballistic missiles at Israel, people in Britain will say, well, why should we step in for Israel's defense? And Iran, of course, wants to knock Israel out of action because it knows mm-hmm. that it will then make it easier for okay. it to attack the West as well. Just as we see, by the way, Iran's proxy army.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, Elon.
I'm just trying to explain. Trying to attack shipping in the Red Sea, which is sending prices soaring. I am. As a result of Iranian aggression.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. That was Elon Levy, former Israeli government spokesperson, and is now the head of the Israeli Citizens Spokesperson Office. Thank you. We've just heard there from Elon Levy, the former Israeli government spokesperson. That's it from Politics Uncensored. Join us next week at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani UK. If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBARradio.com. Thank you for listening and see you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.
FUBAR Radio.